This is going to, I think my paper is going to provide a nice bridge between these other two, so I'm moving into the middle. And certainly I see connections with Brian Cowan's talk, and which I'm glad to pick up on. So hopefully these questions can flow right through. Apologies to Elvis Costello that I don't have permission for this title. So the death of General Wolfe needs little introduction here in Quebec, and for better or for worse, it's become an emblem of British imperial conquest in the 18th century. It was created to reach a large audience at the 1771 Royal Academy Exhibition, and it gained an even larger audience as a print by William Ouellette, which went all over England and indeed all over the world. West's history painting transformed overt imperial aggression into sympathetic, sacrificial victimhood, and it made Canada and territorial empire more generally appear to be part of a divinely inspired plan. The dramatic unfolding of that plan can be seen one century later in Walter Crane's celebrated imperial map of 1886. General Wolfe's conquest of Quebec now extends across Canada, while India, Australia, and major trading ports in Africa, South America, and China complete the imperial circuit. As a tool of empire, cartography rationalized and homogenized this global circuit in a visually persuasive manner. And for those of us who have taught surveys of British imperial history, literature, or of art, it's often convenient to trace the rise of British imperial power and confidence as a relatively straight line between these two points, from the death of Wolfe to the imperial map we see here. But as persuasive as this narrative may be in retrospect, it is deeply deceptive in its particulars. A growing literature has begun to emphasize the unevenness and discontinuities of British imperium. Laws, local customs, geographic constraints, religious difference, linguistic quirks, all of these worked against imperial conformity. The death of General Wolfe and the Federation map are not simply fictions, which I think most all historians would now agree, but they're outright fantasies of political consensus and geographic cohesion. As Felix Driver has observed, fault lines are apparent in this very map for anyone willing to look closely. And I just draw your attention to the fact that we have Britannia sitting on a world which is held up by Atlas, which has human labor on his sash. We have freedom, fraternity, and federation in Frisian-capped young maidens, which recall the ideals of the French Revolution. This is a very odd kind of imperial map in many ways. Indeed, as Driver notes about this map, quote, "This map does not so much represent empire as perform it, though quite what kind of performance might result once all the characters are on stage is not entirely clear." I mean, at the very least, this map performs empire via the complex aims of socialist ideology and the political aims of the Imperial Federation League, which were themselves very complicated at the time. We could say the same thing about the death of General Wolfe as a painting. It was also a product of a fraught political moment between 1767 and 1771 when it was produced. It was done, therefore, virtually a decade after the conquest itself, and it was really responding as much to colonial restiveness in North America as it was for its primary British audience. The Peace of Paris of 1763 formally ratified British imperial possession of Canada, and this arrangement was nearly undone by the colonial American assault on Quebec in 1775. 18th century Britons, in other words, were painfully aware that it was the negotiated terms of peace rather than conquest itself that colored the map pink. In this talk, therefore, I'd like to foreground the role of peace negotiations and peace treaties to popular conceptions of state, nation, and empire. If art historians are exhaustively familiar with the death of General Wolfe, they have had very little to say about representations of peace, a great many of which circulated in popular print culture. This is what the British Empire looked like to a London audience in 1762, as the piece was being debated in the public press. Here's a detail. Britannia is clearly not feeling well, as King George III's ministers force her to take an emetic. A lyric below the image laments, quote, "O disgrace, view our treasures, our conquest thrown up," end quote. And this is literally the case as Britannia vomits out Cuba, the slave trading port of Goree, and other conquests. The actual peace treaty is represented as, quote, "a bubble, an empty exchange for men, money, and trouble." The only supporters of this peace are seen off in the background here being bought off with pensions. London merchants see their business in Newfoundland cod, West Indian sugar, and Chinese tea taken over by foreign countries. In other words, that was what was at stake in this peace treaty for the London market for this print. So today I'd like to offer three separate yet related hypotheses. First, war was considered to be more democratic and more consensual than peace for most of the 18th century. This is counterintuitive, I think, to many of the associations that we typically make about warfare, coercion, conscription, and profiteering in the 20th century, usually being among a very small cohort. If the voices in favor of war in Georgian England were also relatively small and profit-minded, the diplomats and courtiers involved in peace were an even smaller group. And it was a group that was largely unaccountable to the public. And when I refer to public in this talk, I'm talking about a politically literate metropolitan audience for whom satirical prints were primarily designed. Brian Cowan's coffeehouse culture. We could be even more specific and talk about the Middlesex electorate, which was the one kind of politically competitive district in London. And while not hegemonic, the public for this print consisted of political, mercantile, and aspirant classes who viewed Ancien Régime peacemaking as a threat to their own interests. 18th century warfare was profitable and distant for this rising class of Englishmen, and predominantly men. Peace treaties with their closed-door negotiations reeked of corruption. Lord Bute is represented as an ass. He's there with blowing the peace bubble. And Lord Fox is his namesake animal. Britannia's rightful possessions are purged into a bowl held by Louis Baboon, who's obviously the French king. The announcement of each new peace treaty, regardless of its terms, provided potent ammunition for opposition groups to attack the administration in power. While Jürgen Habermas's conception of a public sphere emerging from the English coffee house constituted, at least in part, an antidote to the scourge of 20th century militarism and totalitarianism, it's now clear that the 18th century fiscal military state was politically and economically empowering to many in the polite public sphere. Indeed, Holger Hoke, who can't join us today but whose paper is coming up next, has demonstrated quite effectively that the polite public sphere was, to a surprising degree, coextensive with the fiscal military state, or at least deeply imbricated. My second claim is art historical in nature, and it relates to the shifting style, content, and iconography of satirical peace prints in the 18th century. Now, I've coined the term satirical peace print in order to emphasize the coherence and recurrence of this theme throughout the century. While printed pamphlets delved into the specificities of each individual peace print, and so we can even think, in fact Defoe's, the kind of pamphlet war that Defoe was fighting earlier in the century gets fought at every respective peace treaty that is announced. And they usually go into the terms and they hypothesize about what the secret terms might be. But graphic satire, on the other hand, didn't really care about the terms so much. They were going for maximum political impact with a recurring set of motifs that were being reused, recirculated every time it would come out. And it's precisely the cyclical nature of satirical peace prints that makes them so interesting to art historians, or to this art historian, I should say. For with each new peace treaty, graphic satirists drew upon deep wells of collective imagery. But since these prints appeared only every decade or so, and there was kind of a major war and a major peace nearly every decade in the 18th century, these old motifs would be recirculated in a radically different political environment and also in a different visual environment as the very visual culture of the 18th century progressed and emerged. Indeed, caricature, which is one of the great debates of 18th century art history, how and when and why it emerged in the way that it did, is one thing that gets linked into this, or at least can be unpacked a bit from this recurring motif of the satirical piece print. And then my third claim is spatial and geographic, and it proposes a view of British imperial space that is fragmentary and undifferentiated in the public imagination. This imperial space is comestible and expendable to the English body politic, as we see here. And not to look too carefully at Addington's derriere, but Malta, Saint-Domingue, Egypt, Martinique, they simultaneously represent feces and brightly colored map pieces. That's not a terribly flattering metaphor for one's overseas colonies. Bonaparte demands all of Britain's colonial holdings, while Addington splutters, quote, "Pray do not insist upon Malta. I shall certainly be turned out, and I have got a great many cousins and uncles and aunts to provide for yet." The satire, in other words, implies that these colonies are pawns in a diplomatic game involving fragile egos and nepotistic patronage. The satirical conceit of the emetic, the clyster, or the evacuation, whichever end you want it to come out of, was fairly common in British graphic satire of the 18th century, and it was frequently turned against ministers who were viewed as greedy, corrupt, or fallen. This satire from 1742 shows Robert Walpole being purged of his patronage as he is turned out of the prime minister's office. Beneath the title is a quote from Job, "He hath swallowed down riches, and he shall vomit them up again. God shall cast them out of his belly." This is probably one of the least attractive slides I've ever produced as an art historian. An interesting conceptual shift takes place as evacuations recur every decade or so in satirical piece prints. The bodies of Britannia and Addington, in 2 and 3 there, become surrogates for the empire, and not simply the machinations of court or parliament. Britannia and Addington ingest colonies that the public felt that they should keep down. It's the expulsion of colonies rather than their ingestion that constitutes failure and corruption. This is easier to maintain, I think, with Britannia than it is with a caricature of Addington. And Gilray's playing with the tensions here between a national embodiment and a ministerial caricature. Another common motif in satirical piece prints is the Congress of the Brutes, in which each nation sits at a table represented by their heraldic symbol or animal. This print refers to the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle in 1748. The English lion, the Gallic cock, and the Dutch boar all make deals around a table. This convention could be updated and even naturalized as we see it here, although it's not significantly altered. This 1797 satire personifies the Netherlands, Spain, France, and Britain as they negotiate a treaty at Lille. While the three foreigners are represented as national stereotypes, Britain on the far right is represented by a caricature of the diplomat Lord Malmesbury. An English messenger bursts through the door at the left, carrying written objections to what the English Parliament and presumably the public felt were outrageous French demands. And this embodies a common perception, public perception in London in the 18th century, that the British were better at making war and the French were better at making peace, and that every time the British won these colonies by force, the French won them away through wily negotiation, or won them back through wily negotiation. Now, an unscientific sampling of satirical prints in the British Museum's online database reveals that between 1700 and 1815, there were 838 prints related to war and 535 prints related to peace. Now, some of these prints are one and the same because they bear war and peace in their title or they've been coded that way. And indeed, war might simply get coded more frequently than peace in the way that the British Museum does its cataloging. But this nonetheless provides some indication, I think, of the scale of this visual material, which is very real as you try to sort through it. And also, I think, a surprising equivalence between war and peace in print culture, that we're much more familiar with the theme of war in art. I think particularly in the 18th century that's the case. And a great deal less has been written about the cultural and artistic impact of peace, which is one of the aims of this paper. The later 18th century witnessed an interesting variation on the satirical peace print. Peace had typically been represented as the prerogative of ministers and diplomats in closed-door negotiations, but by the end of the 18th century, printmakers began to represent public responses to peace negotiations and treaties. This satire, titled Peace from 1790, depicts a well-fed government pensioner on one side of the table, debating a thin, uncouth member of the Revolution Society on the other. Particularly striking is the proliferation of maps and prints, and indeed this is a kind of meta-image of the role of print culture in public conceptions of war and peace in the 18th century. A print from one decade later goes even further and represents peace opinions of eight different citizens, including one woman who hopes to, quote, pick and choose a suitor from the returning military officers. All eight citizens are seated, five around a table, helping to privatize the recurring themes of ingestion and negotiation. Beginning in the Revolutionary Wars of the 1790s and then gaining speed during the Napoleonic Wars, a few graphic satires represented peace as a potentially desirable outcome. And this is one of the things I want to emphasize in this talk, is that prior to this moment, virtually every single print that I've seen that refers to peace does so in negative terms. There is no visual culture to speak of that argues for peace in the 18th century visually. But even in the 1795 print by Gilray, which draws a stark contrast between the blessings of peace on the left and the curses of war on the right, there remains a surprising degree of ambivalence. Harriet Guest has noted, quote, "The political implications of visual contrasts or rural scenes were extraordinarily volatile in the 1790s. Depictions of emaciated and desperate Frenchmen set in contrast to fat British farmers gorging on roast beef and plum pudding were subject to the risk that their audience, quote, the poor starving and the middle class unable to live as they were accustomed to live, end quote, might identify with the starving French." In other words, these might become a kind of argument for revolution at home. Gilray's bucolic scene on the left also is inscribed as "such Britain was" in the past tense, while the desolation on the right, quote, "such Flanders, Spain, and Holland now is." Although the family is actually one and the same. Those are the same people. It's the same family in both contexts. Conspicuously absent in this print is any view of what Britain now is. So Gilray, in other words, doesn't actually show anything about what Britain might be in the 1790s. While Gilray's view of peace in that previous print constitutes something of an exception, then Henry Howard's Peace Soup Makers exemplifies the rule among satirical peace prints. And also, I think, graphically, this is more typical, which is to say it's not very sophisticated visually. It fits with a much longer, it's kind of the top piece for a broadside, which is more text-heavy. Arguing that the Scottish Prime Minister, Lord Bute, was incapable of cooking up a hearty peace in 1762, at the end of the Seven Years' War, the song declares, quote, "No longer let bunglers in cookery pretend to poison their tastes for their own private ends. Insipid soup maigre, or crowdy, or salad, are not strong enough for an Englishman's palate. Let your soup, if you have it, be lasting and strong to stick to the ribs of the old and the young. High seasoned and rich, it will add to your vigor and give you fresh courage to draw sword or trigger. If we must have peace, the song suggests, it should be without territorial concessions. It should provide a basis for subsequent imperial conquest." I want to emphasize a notable incuriosity in these prints. There's a complete disregard for foreign cultures or economic trade-offs when it came to imperial expansion. It took the expensive, grinding, threatening wars of 1790 to 1815 to even render peace conceptually desirable in graphic satire, and then, as we've seen, only occasionally. Combining the motifs of peace soup and evacuation, the general piss, or peace, laments yet another treaty gone wrong, this time the 1783 conclusion to the War of American Independence. The print represents an Englishman, a Dutchman, a Native American, which represents the North American colonies, a Spaniard and a Frenchman urinating into a pot. And the Englishman says, "Say what they will, I call this an honorable peace." And the Native American says, "I call this a free and independent peace." The representation of the American colonies as Native Americans was a fairly conventional insult by this time. The colonies themselves had abandoned that motif. And it raises an important point about the satirical peace print tradition. It's extremely rare to find representations of peace treaties between Britain and either the North American Indians, of which there were a great many treaties in the 18th century, or the Mughal rulers of 18th century India. There are just no peace prints about these rulers. To the extent that the peace print, in other words, the general point of the peace print in the 18th century is that Britain is being cheated out of its colonies. So I think if Britain felt that they were doing better on their negotiating end against the Indians, either North American or West or subcontinental, they didn't see a need to represent that. This is a view of the world that is fundamentally unstrategic and non-geographic. On the one hand, print dealers and publications such as the Gentleman's Magazine thrived by selling maps and charts to a public desiring ever greater geographic and imperial knowledge. And there is quite a literature now about map making and its importance to imperial conceptions in the 18th century, to public conceptions of geography and conquest. The satirical peace print revealed a process of willed ignorance on the part of the English public. In other words, I want to emphasize that for all the talk of Londoners and Englishmen wanting to really educate themselves about their new conquests, the peace print is an alternate tradition in which they really don't care. That's not the point of these. In these prints, colonies and their subjects are interchangeable ingredients in a hearty or more common, a meager peace soup. At the same time, satirical peace prints are refreshingly honest about the contingencies of imperial sovereignty. The question was not whether a territory could or should be conquered. That was simply taken for granted. It was rather how long it was going to be before it was traded away. And here we see Gilray in a phantasmagoria, conjuring up an armed skeleton, viewing, kind of taking that notion of peace soup to another level here, combining it with Shakespeare and the three witches from Macbeth. And you see that they're pouring in, gold is going into the pot along with the English lion whose head has been decapitated and now they're boiling its body. And they're pouring in pieces of paper that also here describe the different places such as Dominion of the Sea, Egypt, Malta, Cape Continental Alliances are all being burned to stoke the fire. And out of it emerges an allegorical figure of Britannia, but this time she's been boiled to the bones. And she's the representation of peace. Published in 1803 as a response to the proposed terms of the Peace of Amiens, the Phantasmagoria references a device for optical illusions that produced them with a projecting lantern. This was a new invention by a Frenchman. It had been taken up in London. It was part of this whole wonderful visual culture in London of ever greater optical effects. And in fact, you can see, it's hard to say, it's a little bit bright, but you can see that this image is actually projected on a brick wall. You can see the bricks in the back. So he's actually suggesting something, again, Gilray is being more subtle here than the initial print would read. Certainly you could take the obvious fact that this is a peace print along the tradition of so many others and read it simply that way as another print against the peace. But as a phantasmagoria, you might also read it as the projection of a paranoid opposition, or perhaps the frantic imagining of an overzealous public. 2 years later, in 1805, Gilray produced what's sometimes considered the most famous caricature of all time, or certainly one of the most reproduced caricatures of all time. How many folks have seen this image before? Okay, good. A good two-thirds of you out there have. I've shown it many times myself. In all kinds of contexts. And I've always done the same thing that most art historians do, which is to take its meaning as self-evident. To say very little about it, to kind of show it as an emblem of imperial grandeur, With a trident, fork, and a carving knife, William Pitt plunges through the Atlantic Ocean. As Tate Britain's Gilray exhibition described the print, quote, "This is a brilliant illustration of the respective areas of power of the two countries," end quote. And that's what I've often said about it in class. But now, actually, in the context of the satirical piece print, I'm seeing it very differently, and I'm actually seeing that reading as a very superficial one. I would describe the etching as a prospective piece print, for it imagines what the world might look like if William Pitt accepted the peaceful overtures that a recently elevated Emperor Napoleon sent to the King of England in January of 1805. This print, I'll just remind you, was published in February of 1805, the end of February. Given the iconographic tradition traced here, we should be prepared to find that this meal could turn deeply unappetizing. Gilray's title describes the plum pudding as being in danger, which is a strange way of personifying the globe. And the subtitle reads, quote, "The great globe itself and all which it inherit," which is in quotes, "is too small to satisfy such insatiable appetites." Now, the first half of that subtitle is a quote from Shakespeare, more specifically, The Tempest, Prospero's speech in Act 4, Scene 1. And I'm just going to read a brief part of that speech. Quote, "Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." These are not the most solid of foundations, I think you'll agree, for an empire. And even if this repast is more substantial than a dream, it could easily result in food poisoning. And that's exactly what we find in this print, which commemorates Napoleon's abdication in 1814. The prince regent stands behind him saying, "I think now, my little fellow, you're pretty well cleared out, and I hope you will never give us the trouble to prescribe or proscribe any more," end quote. In the regent's right hand is a large rolled document reading Treaty of Peace. Now, I should mention, the English never actually show themselves vomiting up, or Pitt vomiting up his possessions. But I think the fact that they can view Napoleon doing as much, and I think that there's the latent possibility for that to come up in this print, which is one of the things I want to emphasize. We should not, in other words, read The Plum Pudding in Danger back through the lens of Walter Crane's Imperial Map. An anonymous contributor to the Spectator magazine in 1873 discussed Gilray's print in these terms, which, in other words, here's a commentator on the print writing at about the time of Walter Crane's Imperial Map. And this is, in fact, one of the longest descriptions I've ever found of the print on the left, and I'm going to read just a section of it. Quote, "Pitt, with a sort of priggish formality, as if he were a mere servant, doing the modestest thing in the world, is cutting off just half of the pudding, the hemisphere of the sea into which he is striking his trident, while Great Britain remains on the other half, of which he is evidently intending to take the larger part for a second helping. Napoleon, with a lurid wildness of manner, which indicates the gamester or the madman, is just carving away the better part of Europe, his fork being stuck very viciously into the center of Hanover. The power of the caricature consists in the contrast between the expressions of the two diners. Pitt is discharging a formal duty with an air of decorous frigidity, his mouth shut with the primmest precision. Napoleon is rolling his eyes in lunatic ecstasy, with his parted lips preparing greedily for a bite. The caricature could not have expressed with more deadly effect the contrast between the cool official routine that does big things without knowing it and the glaring theatrical temper that broods on its own achievements and is always trying to appear to do even bigger things than it does." Now, so this is on the one hand, I think, a very good piece of analysis, better than we normally get in terms of formal description. But on the other hand, its description is a fantastic projection, I think, in which Pitt's dignity is contrasted with Napoleon's depravity. I don't see that contrast. I'd be happy to hear from others if I'm missing something. In fact, echoes of this very same analysis persist in Dorothy George's more measured description of the print from 1947. Quote, "Pitt looks warily at Napoleon, who stares fiercely at the pudding." The print appears to me to capture a profound equity between the two powers that's appropriate to its historical moment. I mean, 1805 was a very, very tense moment in the balance of power in Europe and the globe. Like most satirical peace prints, this one maintains a rigorously cosmopolitan focus on global events. Monarchs, ministers, and diplomats alone determine the fate of nations and empires. The West Indies are written on Pitt's slice of the globe, and they may have even supplied the sugar necessary to make the plum pudding, but actual slaves and planters have no place in this worldview. Exceptional is the non-Western leader, such as the southern Indian ruler Tipu Sultan, who became a recurring subject in English graphic satire. Or stated another way, caricature emerged as a subjective visual mode that rendered complex global wars and treaties personal. Caricature has been described by Amelia Rouser as a manifestation of a new kind of personal subjectivity. She writes, quote, "Caricature is paradoxical because it seems to allow an impossibility crucial to us moderns. While still relying on surfaces and while acknowledging the gap between sign and signified, caricature purports to excavate the truth and to close that representational gap, remaking the surface into a truthful analog of the depths beneath," end quote. Rouser refers to the gap between surface and depth in the caricature of individuals, but the satirical peace print suggests a similar gap in the representation of nations. Gilray invites the London public into an imaginative game in which personal and political foibles correspond mysteriously, almost magically, to deeper imperial truths. So to conclude, if the plum pudding in danger has appeared triumphalist to many, it's because we know that Britain managed to keep sizable chunks of the globe down. This outcome was far from certain in 1805. Gilray's print points not to a Victorian sense of imperial destiny, but rather to an older tradition of the satirical peace print. It was a tradition in which the English public was invited to laugh nervously at British military force and to impulsively reject all offers of peace. Thank you. Okay, great. Yes, sir.
You suggested that the satirical print culture of the 18th century was intended to influence the public against militarism, in effect. But the public was largely illiterate and had no vote. So what public are we talking about? It would seem to me that it's rather than the public, it's one part of the establishment criticizing another part of the establishment in terms of policy, because I don't see much evidence of the public getting involved in all of this.
Okay, thank you. Two quick points. One is that the question of what the public or what the audience was for satirical peace prints is still very much in debate and very much in question. There is no doubt that it's intended, at the very least, for the political establishment, for those sitting members of Parliament and those who have a political voice. But as the 18th century progresses, there is absolutely an enfranchisement. And I said at one point the political public could be viewed here as narrowly as the Middlesex electorate, which is to say the one competitive district in all of England for which John Wilkes was elected repeatedly, was in fact deeply competitive, and you did have to politic for that seat. And that would be the narrowest reading would be an English voting public in the Middlesex district. But I do think that there is evidence, and there's a lot of debate, and Brian would be a good voice on this as well, about there is a larger enfranchisement, and there's also the kind of informal enfranchisement that comes around political debate and politicking that we would need to take account of. But your question is right on the money in terms of what is being debated right now in the field.
I think you're rather underestimating the condition of Britain. That it was not really a united kingdom. You forgot many of those prints actually are criticisms of the Scots. You mentioned Wilkes, he had the anti-Scots riots. And those caricatures were intended to comment on England being destroyed by the Scots. And, you know, the Scots actually change. If you look at the 18th century, the Highlanders, 45, they're bad. Bute there, 1763, he's bad, he's Presbyterian Scot. The first speaker ignored that concept. The Scots were Presbyterian, English were Episcopalian. That was a stress within Britain. And your comments, I think, have missed the point that these caricatures were anti-Scots. I happen to be Scot, so I'm perhaps a bit sensitive to that fact. But the Scots actually changed, and by 1815, you know, the Highlanders at Waterloo, they defeat the French, and the Scots are part of, you know, Linda Colley's idea that wars forged Britain in the 18th century, that it wasn't really a united kingdom until 1815, when, you know, and the Scots were, of course, you mentioned Canada, the Scots in Canada were terribly important. They did very well out of the empire. The Scots in the American Revolution were far more anti-revolutionary than the English. You know, the Scots were actually outlawed in many US states. So I think, could you comment on this aspect of a changing Britain? Britain changed in the 18th century. Second, there was no universal British empire. The concept of the empire was different. There was no empire. So it was just a collection of entirely different places. So would you comment?
Yeah, no, I agree with that comment entirely. In fact, I mean, the 1763 Peace of Paris, almost every single one of those caricatures is anti-Scots because of Lord Bute. And in fact, I've in my book on British art in the Seven Years' War, my main emphasis is actually on the impossibility of integrating the Scots into the British Empire. So I'm absolutely in agreement with that. And it does begin to change. I mean, your point is well taken. And one of the things I wanted to emphasize is that we can't read it, the integration of empire, as a straight line between Death of Wolfe to Walter Crane's map. But one of the things I like about this satirical piece print is that they are, I mean, ostensibly their subject matter is always the terms of peace, which are usually overseas territories. I mean, this is one of the venues in which Londoners are contemplating what the empire is in the 18th century by definition. They're saying, do we want Goree? Do we want the West Indies? Do we, you know, what are the trade-offs? And how is this imagined? And again, I think even here, 1805, you're right. I mean, this is often read as a notion of a coherent British imperium that is really actually still very much fractured, but we do tend to read it back through that lens. So I'm in complete agreement, but I do think that there are ways in which this satirical piece print tradition is kind of compelling people to think about what the empire is globally, but with the full realization that they're in no agreement as to what it is, even internally.
Sorry. I think the caricature is extremely interesting as it pursues the European hegemony. I mean, both characters, I mean, it actually looks like there's a sort of superimposition of moral analysis, like a critique of avidity as a vice. And you have almost a representation of European colonialism as deal-making, which you mentioned, as a vice. But look at Napoleon, he looks like he has been given an illness. He actually doesn't look like himself. Plus, that's an image of him as a very young man that I've never seen his features looking like that. Like, his eyes have been really enlarged, and it looks like he's been given some symptoms of an illness.
Yes, well, I mean, and I agree, and I think... Sorry. I think that, and the pit looks just as bad, and so this... Well, we'll have to. I mean, he's. It's a caricature of both, and no doubt. And so that there is.
Well, one's consuming the empire with the eyes, and the other's consuming it with the nose, like almost like sniffing it up. It's like
I like that.
Like they're consuming the globe, and I think this is a brilliant caricature. I don't know who did it or whether you have more.
No, sorry, this is by James Gilray, if I didn't make it clear. And so this is, this is definitely one of his more well-known caricatures. And there's actually, there's a reference to William Wyndham and within the subtitle. And I've been searching this down, but there were, under debate in 1805, I think what this print actually really references is a very vigorous debate about the size of the British military. And whether it should be a professional military or a militia or both, and what the real threat of invasion from France was, and what it takes to keep up the empire. That's the debate that's really being discussed here, and I do think that Gilray is critiquing a kind of perpetual war, a perpetual militarism within the state I think that Gilray is. On the whole, and I'm still trying to come to terms with this, what Gilray's attitude towards empire was, and it's very hard to pin down. And I don't know that it's even possible or necessary to pin it down. But I do think here we're talking about a reaction to never-ending war and never-ending conscription and never-ending militarism. So I think that's an important point.
So you're suggesting that the military becomes essential as a manager of the peace and a manager of the empire.
Yes. Well, it clearly takes a lot of men and navies to keep feeding these kinds of insatiable appetites. But I think it's probably a longer explanation. But I think this actually might be an example of Gilray leaning towards peace. Although I doubt that he would have. Whether he was really arguing for. The peace that Napoleon's offering in 1805 may be another question, but I don't think it has to be either or. It could be a kind of sense that if we don't take this peace, when and how will peace ever come might be the question.
Yeah, I have a question. I have a narrative of the historiography. Listening to you, I have a narrative of the historiography of studies on imperialism, and your study would have a happy place in that narrative, but I wonder if you agree with my narrative or whatever.
Okay.
That's part of the conscious project.
Okay.
And that's just that, so you have studies on imperialism and anti-imperialism, and then you have sort of the heyday of post-colonial studies, which if it hasn't already been done, you have to declare over, where I think the largest excess was an obligation to find colonial ambivalence, which sometimes went to absurd lengths. And in your study of the peace satires in the 18th century, it's really hard to find that colonial ambivalence. And this is quite different from what post-colonial studies required of us in the 90s and first decades of the 2000s. Do you agree with that? Is that part of your conscious project? And is that an accurate way to look at what you're doing?
I do think it's an accurate way. I think my thinking inevitably fits within that trajectory that you're describing. I mean, this is clearly a metropolitan view of the larger picture rather than... satire, you're never going to find any kind of colonial agency or resistance within graphic satire, right? I mean, that would be a doomed project in and of itself. So, I mean, the very desire to see empire through caricature is going to be limited by that frame. And I think that we are in a historiographic moment that makes it a little bit more amenable than it would have been before. But I also have hesitations about wanting to kind of valorize the need for this project along those lines. I think, there's a part of me that actually is I'm finding really interesting about this project now is James Gilray, I have to say. And one of the things I think he's doing, I'm beginning to think of James Gilray as an analog to Bob Dylan. And this is going to sound a bit, but bear with me for a second. But the idea is that I think what makes Gilray so, people tend to view Gilray as, through Baudelaire's eyes, as the great modern genius who's not appreciated until later. I actually think that Gilray's genius is kind of like Bob Dylan's genius in relationship to the American folk music tradition. What Gilray is doing is he's channeling this incredibly deep, broad, the old weird England, if I'm going to use Grail Marcus as my guide, into something that is both his own and not his own. I mean, he's plagiarizing left and right in the same way that Dylan would be plagiarizing, and that he's creating. So, and I think also strikingly, he actually comes at the end of a tradition. In fact, he's really the end of this. He's not the beginning of this. And caricature, may get started in the 1750s and 60s, And caricature never goes away. And in fact, I think caricature is something of a red herring in these debates. And so I think caricature is one element among a great many visual tools that Gilray has at his disposal. So actually, what I'm beginning to see this as part of Gilray and the English political imagination as a project, actually. So, but where empire is important, but not central. Okay. Thanks.